Welcome to another
edition of the... Oh, yeah.
Really thought I could get something usable that I could edit to. This is...
Nope.
This is the Thinking Like a Lawyer podcast. I'm Joe Patrice from Above the Law. Unfortunately, I'm also joined by Catherine...
Unfortunately?
Sorry, wow. That was a slip. I'm also joined by Catherine Rubino and Chris Williams from my colleagues over at Above the Law, and we're here to do this show, which we do every week, where we talk about the bigger legal stories from the week that was over at Above the Law. But as per usual, we begin by showing a little bit of our human side with a segment we call Small Talk.
Small Talk.
Okay.
How was your weekend, Joe?
It was great. I did a debate tournament thing. We got through that. I got home late last night. And I'm here.
I don't think you understand the purpose of small talk, perhaps.
That is still work.
I did nothing else but that. Well, no, it's not work. It is not about Above the Law in any way.
Okay, let me clarify. Your other job?
Yeah. Look, I do mostly
work. That's your small talk?
I do mostly work. Like, I, unlike some people.
Wow.
Oh, no.
Wow. Okay. Right. Chris, how was your weekend? Maybe we can demonstrate for him what small talk actually looks like.
Oh, it was great. You know, me and my baby, we watched this show called Yu Yu Hakusho. And it's one of the best animes ever. And one of the fun things is I'm a nerd in a way that they're not. So we're walking through like different shows that I like, and they're like, oh, this is great. I'm like, yeah. So that's been cool. There's this game I'm playing, so on the side, called Monster Hunter Rise, which is the sequel to Monster Hunter World. And it's a different combat system, but it's similar enough to be like, oh, I'm so used to these controls. And it's cool to see how there's different iterations of the monsters that I'm used to fighting. And then there's also new monsters. And I've, you know, just been going on rampages because one, I've been killing a lot of monsters. And two, there's this new feature for the game called Rampage. There's like a siege mode. And like, there's a whole bunch of like monsters that like come at you and like cannons and ballista and whatnot. It's really fun.
Awesome.
Other than that, I've really just been in the house. But it's been a decent weekend, caught up on some sleep and much needed.
That's awesome. I started a book club with some friends of mine, which I'm pretty excited about.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. I'm kind of jazzed. We all have kind of similar tastes generally in books. And so we put a couple of selections, each of us, into a hat. Mine did not get selected, but that's okay. I'm still excited to
start. Wait, you made a selection? Does Taylor Swift have an autobiography I don't know about?
You're so funny. No, my selection was actually The Survivalist by Kashana Cawley, who is actually a former colleague of mine. She and I worked together when we were at Wilson Sonsini, but she is also a very successful writer. Yeah, she's written for Trevor Noah and other people, and she's has a novel out that I haven't had a chance to read yet. So I was like, let's make all my friends read the book that I want to read anyway, but maybe next month.
I felt that way about when I was teaching. I was like, I've been planning to watch this James Baldwin documentary for a while. I'll just assign it to my students, and that way it'll force me to, you know.
That you get to watch it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, reading has not necessarily been the thing as a new mom that I am most focused on, but I feel like, you know, creating a book club really creates that kind of accountability that will force me to, you know, read it while I'm pumping or doing whatever I need to do.
That makes sense. Right now I'm reading this book called Dear Santhoran. I don't remember the author's first name, but I think the last name is Akweke. And I think the first book they wrote was Freshwater. It's an interesting read. The sentences are simple, blunt, and just heavy. Like, it'll be like, oh, it's raining outside. The rain reminds me of my tears. Anyway, time to eat some cereal. I'm like, what?
Oh, hi, Mark.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a fun read. We're doing like a bit of a cultural exchange. So like showing Aquila animes, and they like have a book that they like that I wanted to read and what have you. So it's like a back and forth thing.
Oh, that's fun. See, Joe, that is small talk. See, we talked about things that were not related to, not even just, okay, you want to talk about a debate tournament, fine. But you're like, it happened. Boom, that's it. Like, there's no sense of who you
are.
Here's
a reprover human. I did a thing.
Lows.
Okay, next.
Yeah, like literally your sentence and the tone in which you delivered it also could have just been, you know, AI generated.
Okay.
Yeah. Honestly, I know you AI folks are listening. We have the tips hotline. One of you needs to send in a chat Joe Patrice that just compiles a lawyer content.
I put early on in ChatGPT's unveiling, so I guess back when it was still 3.5 exclusively, I put in a write something in the style
what
of Joe Patrice.
How'd that go? And,
well,
was it robotic?
It seemed like a bad caricature. Like it would say things and then just spice in Simpsons references and basketball metaphors and stuff. And I was like, I get why you think I would do things like that. Like it made sense sort of, but it was clumsy and not really.
Okay. So for myself and listeners at home, what's the bright line between bad and accurate?
Ooh, it did not read like an engaging human article.
Good news. The AI can't do our jobs.
But it did. It did grab like random habits that I probably have about sports analogies and The Simpsons that, fair.
Yeah,
I'll give it that. I've always described it to people as it's what a bad caricature must feel like if you're on Saturday Night Live and somebody does that.
Oh, we'll which have to obviously, ask Ellie.
Yeah. Which obviously our former co-host Ellie Mastal was a character on Saturday Night Live recently, of course. And though that was pretty straight up. I mean, the whole point of it was that he kept getting cut off. So
yeah.
I guess we didn't really see the impression. Anyway, well, that's actually a good segue, but let's get out of small talk and we can segue. So yeah, this has been a banner run for Above the Law. Like we had Ellie, a character on Saturday Night Live, and then Stephen Colbert featured Above the Law in the monologue last week.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Not any of our articles, of course, but our columnist Liz Dye, who is pretty exclusively these days on the Trump legal trouble beat, not for any reason, but the fact that there's so much to cover.
So much.
she could write probably double her production and still just write pretty exclusively about Trump legal troubles.
Yeah.
So.
And like, it's horrible for the state of our democracy or whatever, but as far as content,
there is that kind of uncomfortable push pull where you're like, oh, this is terrible for, you know, our country, people are going to click the shit out of this.
Yeah, I'm like, oh my God, it's a slow day. There's nobody bribing Clarence. You know,
that's an interesting point, and one that, well, you know, is broader than her actual story here, which eventually we'll talk about. But since you gave the entree to it, it does speak to the importance of having sort of open opinion-based journalism as opposed to kind of faux objective journalism, because there's a
great
argument.
Faux objective journalism is owned by like six corporations.
Sure, but
that's also true.
But I don't even necessarily think that's in many of their instances the source of the problem, because a lot of those entities are pretty good about their firewalling off of stuff. It becomes an issue when they start laying people off, but like that, you know, so long as they're successful, they don't do that. But the problem with the faux objective journalism is this is the whole thing about Trump's whole political rise, the fixation on emails and for Hillary's emails or Biden's age. There's coverage that blows out of proportion dumb stories as though they're important because they sell papers, and they put them out there as though and frame them as though these are important when they're really doing it because they sell papers. And that's distinct from, you know, where people who are much more open about their motive, you know, about how their feelings, when we say, you know, we get a lot of, hey, it's good for content that Trump does awful things, but we're going to tell you that they're awful things. You know, we're making clear that we would just as soon go back to having more stories about bonuses.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd love to just write, you know, for a while exclusively about, you know, what's going on in big law, but then I would be missing key elements of what's happening in the legal world, and you know, that'd probably not be great either.
Yeah, it's annoying because some of those situations we don't want to necessarily be the first line of coverage, because some of them are courtroom things where like we don't have the resources to have a court, you know, somebody in a courtroom.
Right, we're much more secondary Atlanta. Sourcing than primary sourcing.
Yeah, and so those are stories that aren't ideal necessarily, but if we don't write about them, it seems like we have missed what legal is doing, since that is most of what's happening. Anyway,
there's this, I think there's this line from like a Palestinian poet, and it's like, I'd rather write about birds chirping, but for me to do that, I'd have to not be hearing bombs all the time.
Right. So let's get back to the actual story. The actual story that ended up being on Stephen Colbert that Liz wrote was about the cases here in New York. Trump, and you know, Trump owes some money up here to appeal those. He can appeal those without posting bond, but if he wants to appeal those without paying 100% of what he owes first, he needs to, you know, either get a stay of the requirement of the execution of those judgments or post a bond of some sort, whatever. He put forward a fairly bold motion claiming that he shouldn't have to put up his money here because he's too rich to have to do that.
That seems like the opposite.
That is normally the opposite of these situations, yes.
It is, but for a long time, I thought to myself, wouldn't it be nice to just have fuck you money, where you have enough money where people leave you alone? So like in some twisted way, it kind of makes sense, but it's...
So usually the purpose of these bonds is that you don't want somebody to say, I'm gonna go appeal this, and in the meantime, squander all the resources so that you can't actually get paid when I eventually lose and confirm that I lose. His argument that he's too rich to have to put up the money is he says, well, I'm so rich, there's no risk I would squander all this money before I could be have my judgment executed upon. So therefore, I shouldn't have to even bother putting it up. This is lunacy, obviously.
Yeah.
And I do appreciate, you know, the way you phrased that was a good one.
Yeah, and obviously the plaintiffs have pointed this out. But the crux of it for me is I think it speaks to a longstanding issue. And, you know, it's why Trump's always been very aggressive about not handing over his tax returns and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I think this really speaks to he is not, in fact, as rich as he likes to say he is. Mm-hmm. And it's why he's having his campaign pay his legal bills and so on. He doesn't have any of this money. Now, he may have a worth that's high like that to the extent he owns real property in places, buildings and golf clubs and stuff that mm-hmm. can be liquidated, but it's a cash poor situation. I don't think he actually has very much walking around money to be putting up in these situations. And he knows that to come up with that amount of money, he would have to start selling things. And I think he might well have some properties that selling would be bad for him. So I think what we've gotten confirmed by his frantic efforts to say that he's too rich to put up a bond is that he is not, in fact,
too rich.
Rich enough to put up a bond.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, though.
It is. Well, you know, like you got to kind of respect the hustle there. Like there were
<Do I? laughs>
there were other arguments, and he makes other arguments why he shouldn't have to and yada yada. But to roll with, I have too much money to be a concern that I might leave was really, really an impressive move.
I think that it's this sort of boldness of a lot of the legal filings in the various Trump cases that really are the most sort of gobsmacking. Like, you wrote that down and then submitted it to a court.
Yeah.
Like, what?
I just imagine that there's like some fundamental misunderstanding here. Like some accountant was like, hey, too much of your money is in real estate. You don't have any liquid assets. And he was like, I have too much money. Oh, great. And then he just said,
but he didn't file it, right? Like it has to go through an actual attorney who's admitted to a bar.
Well, so that's the segue I was going with, which is there's always a push pull with a client where you're trying to represent their interests. And sometimes that means telling them I'm not going to make the argument you want me to. You are in a service-based economy, but also part of that service is protecting them when they're wrong. And that does create some issues. And this goes back to a few weeks ago, we were talking about the emails and that you could see in the emails that Trump's lawyers were sending back and forth with the judge, how they kind of went from, in writing style, a very clear-headed, legal-ease kind of writing style to
get off my lawn,
insane, unhinged stuff. You realize that this is there's a turnover point where they just are forwarding on things Trump wrote them directly. And you see that here too. Like, some of these arguments are situations where stronger willed lawyers would say, no, we're not doing that. But they can't get over.
Well, I mean, they would probably get fired.
Or choose not to. Yeah. Right.
One thing I found out that's really easy to tell when Trump is actually just parroting through his lawyer is Trump talking when everything is in caps lock.
Yeah.
So if it looked like he was screaming, I have too much money, that was Trump.
McDermott Will & Emery is Vault's number one law firm for associate satisfaction 3 years running. Why? Because they're doing big law better. At McDermott, you define what your success looks like. They help you achieve it. McDermott's award-winning professional development program and hands-on mentorship propel you toward your goals, while the industry-leading wellness benefits help you feel your best so you can do your best. Want to see how your life could be better at McDermott? Head to mwe.com/above the law. Generate quality briefs, memos, and redlines in minutes with Callidus AI. You enter the case's facts, then Callidus suggests bodies of law, statutes, and precedents. You tell it if those are relevant, and Callidus generates a well-cited, well-formatted document. You can trust what went into it because you put it there. Be exceptionally productive with better outcomes using Legal's most advanced AI platform. Just 3 minutes from registration to results. Get $90 off your first 2 months. Use promo code Joe at CallidusAI.com. That's CallidusAI.com. So in the interests of continuing our conversation about Trump, I guess, let's talk. The immunity case was taken up by the Supreme Court last week. Obviously, this was the case where Trump says that because he used to be president, he can't be criminally tried for anything he did while he was president. This argument specifically talks about is specifically raised in the January 6th case in D.C. There's a possibility it could apply to other things, though there's arguments whether or not it would, because there's slightly different fact patterns. But this was raised in D.C. It went to the D.C. Circuit. This is the D.C. Circuit case where the Trump camp had the rather embarrassing claim, made the rather embarrassing explicit claim that presidents can assassinate their rivals, assuming the Senate doesn't vote to convict them and never be held accountable, which the best tweet I saw immediately after that was said in the oral argument in the D.C. Circuit was somebody wrote, Joe Biden has the opportunity to do the funniest thing.
fair. Not that I appreciate what he said, but there's an honesty, at least there. And at least, you know, there can be no pretending that that isn't the natural and logical consequences of what they're arguing, right? It's not like some judge can say, yeah, agree to it and say like, well, we didn't think it could mean this. They're like, no, it could. Right here, right now, we're admitting it.
So the argument was that even though there's no real reason to believe the presidents are immune from criminal liability, that somehow they have to be impeached and convicted by the Senate first before criminal proceeding can begin. This runs contrary to the actual statements of several senators who voted to acquit him in his second impeachment, saying, we're not going to convict on this impeachment. He can be charged criminally. So that was clearly their intent. He argued that he was immune. The D.C. Circuit, after taking a long time, wrote a very lengthy and detailed opinion explaining that, no, this makes no sense. That was theoretically going to be the end of it. The Supreme Court decided last week that they would take up this case. The practical implication of this, of course, is that it's not just that they're going to take it up, but in a world in which their emergency powers are rapid and extreme, indeed, earlier today we got the Colorado ballot ruling all, you know, handed down in an opinion that the justices didn't even bother going to court for, I hear. They decided not even to expedite this, that they're going to, you know, they'll hear oral argument maybe at the end of April on this issue. Yeah. This then sets up a situation where they'll probably drag this out until June or later to get an actual opinion on it. This then means in the meantime, it's also true that it, even though they took up this case, which delays all that delays the risk of a trial happening before the election in the first place, they also managed to get five votes at least, I believe, because four votes to take the thing up, but I believe it took five to stay the original ruling in the meantime, which they did do, meaning that the trial can't go forward until this is resolved, which in the normal course, you would just go forward with it. And if they resolve it the other way, they, you know,
so
they reverse it, but like that you at least maximize your judicial resources. So they stayed this, meaning they had the votes to push this off into the future. Now, is the Supreme Court going to rule that you can actually assassinate your political opponent without any repercussions?
Maybe. Probably not.
Almost certainly not. There is almost certainly not five votes for that.
I do love your faith in the system, Joe.
Well,
I think it's probably true.
It's just ridiculous.
Yeah,
that said, but they don't, I don't think anybody, maybe Alito, I don't think anybody actually thinks that that's going to be the result here. Mm-hmm. But what they are capable of doing, those that voted for this, taking this case up, is that they can delay this. And then maybe Trump wins and then, you know.
Then Bob's your uncle, yeah.
Yeah. And
I love that saying, by the way. Bob's your
uncle. Yeah, such a good
it's
one.
So
yeah.
Good. But, who the fuck is Bob?
I don't, yeah, right. But I don't understand how, what my takeaway from it was, it's such a weird move for the Supreme Court, who spends so much of its time, the majority of the Supreme Court, complaining that the public doesn't respect them anymore. We see Gallup polls, they're becoming increasingly less respected. We have Amy Coney Barrett going around publicly complaining that people pay too much attention to us. I wish that we could go back to where we were kind of obscure, all this. They hate this.
Mm-hmm.
And
then they keep doing it.
And
it's
the answer
like,
here.
Like they don't. It's like they don't actually hate it. They actually kind of get off on the attention and the whole like bad attention is still attention. They're like toddlers that way.
Knowing that there's no way they're going to agree to, yes, presidents are have absolute immunity for everything. Given that they aren't going to do that, taking this up does nothing but make the court look bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like they could have just let this go and faded into obscurity, but they chose not to. And none of this even matters if Trump loses. Like this was all just a complete sideshow.
Yeah.
Because this is all a bid, assuming he wins, he can then cancel all the prosecutions against him in for 4 years or more, depending on when he chooses to take office for life. But it's so short-sighted of an institution desperately seeking to get itself back to respectability. And that respectability, I gotta say, like I'm saying this, I kind of like that they don't have respectability because I don't agree with their current policy stance. But like, if I were giving them advice earnestly, you're going to be a lot better off if you're going to be a lot better off passing rulings that get your worldview imposed if people don't think you're hacks, where you can claim that what you're doing has some real grounding in the Constitution or whatever. Like this move was just so politically short-sighted.
Yeah, and I wonder though if it's short-sighted or perhaps longer-sighted in the sense that they have lifetime appointments and they don't have to win election, but if Trump wins election, that cements their position for the next, you know, couple of nominations or whatever. And even if, you know, it's only 4 years that Trump is in office, but they don't need to be popular now. They can be popular in 5 years. And fundamentally, the attention span of the American public is not noted for being particularly long.
Well, you get to a point or are getting to a point that was Ellie's angle, was that there's also folks who on that court who, while it may be bad for the court itself, they don't want to be there anymore and they would like to be replaced by Republicans. People like Thomas and Alito would love a situation where they could step down without shifting the balance of power.
I mean, I'm not sure that's true. I don't think that they would like to step down. I think that they would like the comfort in knowing if they happen to die, they'll be replaced.
That's a fair point.
I don't think either of them will ever step down.
Friendly amendment taken.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think that the fact that I can see that with respect to both sides of the aisle, frankly, that, you know, it's both a problem for Democrats and Republicans who are on the court that they won't step down. You know, the Ginsburg problem is the problem,
yeah.
You know, not just because, you know, Ginsburg was replaced with Coney Barrett or, you know, that's not the only reason, but it's okay to retire. You know, take a tip from Sandra Day O'Connor. It's okay to pull away from the court.
Yeah.
Hey, Gee, what's up?
Just having some lunch, Conrad.
Hey, Gee, do you see that billboard out there?
Oh, you mean that guy out there in the gray suit?
Yeah, the gray suit guy.
Order up.
There's all those beautiful, rich, leather-bound books in the background.
That is exactly the one. That's J.D. McGuffin at law. He'll fight for you!
I bet you he has got so many years of experience.
Like decades and decades. And I bet, Gee, I bet he even went to a law school.
Are you a lawyer? Do you suffer from dull marketing and a lack of positioning in a crowded legal marketplace? Sit down with Gee and Conrad for Lunch Hour Legal Marketing on the Legal Talk Network. Available wherever podcasts are found.
Speaking of the Supreme Court, they have a new clerk coming in.
Well, they got a bunch, but one that is already infamous, at least in the pages of Above the Law, Crystal Clanson, I Just Can't Quit You. I've written a ton about Crystal Clanson over the past couple of years. She is a former Turning Point USA employee, and she got blown up because she wrote to coworkers, "I hate black people, like, fuck them all. I hate blacks. End of story."
Right. So now, allegedly did that. We know those texts exist.
Yes.
She says she doesn't remember them.
Yes. She says she doesn't remember them, but it does not reflect who she is.
Right. Who amongst us doesn't, you know, black out and type a bunch of racial, you know.
Yeah. And there were also other reports of bigoted comments from Clanton. They were not the only set of reports that this is true. She was forced out of Turning Point USA. She bounced back, though, and got a job working for Ginny Thomas. What embarrassing story for the Supreme Court is complete without a reference to Ginny Thomas?
Now, she claims she can't, like, apologize or deal or anything for these because she's got some sort of an NDA, I gather, with Turning Point, whatever. Her stepping stone was she went and worked for Judge Pryor.
After working for Ginny, she went to Aslaw. She went to George Mason Law School. And from there, she worked for Corey Mays, first of Northern District of Alabama, then 11th Circuit, William Pryor. And it was just announced last week that she will be clerking for Clarence.
Right. Pryor said that he wrote something about how she didn't write them. It was some hacking attempt sort of a thing, which is weird because that doesn't even comport with her own weird quasi story of it. So whatever, put that to aside. All this happened. Now on the Supreme Court, several people, including you, have pointed out that, you know, it's a little rough for the world that somebody who might have been fired for being too racist for Turning Point is now on the Supreme Court. You got some pushback from a law professor on this claim.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm not the only one who will refer to Crystal Clanson as the "I hate black people" clerk or whatever her latest job is. And Professor Lubit from Northwestern wrote an article in Slate saying that we, you know, need to give Crystal Clanson a break, that this was a youthful indiscretion at best, and that Clarence Thomas is satisfied that she's not or no longer biased or a bigot. So, you know, this should be seen as a success story. But, you know, it might be nice if there was some earnest attempt of either apologizing, doing something that would indicate that she's no longer, that the things that she allegedly texted were not true. There's no sort of donation to any causes that, you know, work towards ending racism. There's no nothing. It's just further moving up the ladder of the right wing power structure. And when wherever she eventually winds up in the course of her career, I don't think it's going to be a surprise that this is how she first became at least known in legal circles.
I mean, we had a guy who, like, I think it was like 94, passed a crime bill that was super predatory on black folks, ended up becoming the president by saying, if you don't vote for me, you're not black. So I think that, you know, she's got a there's a history of people being able to do a bunch of anti-black stuff and still be successful and then be able to be like, hey, black folks, you got to vote for me. So I don't really think she'll get in that much trouble. Talking about Joe Biden, by the way.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm reminded, you know, like these sorts of youthful indiscretion kind of arguments. On the one hand, you want to be somewhat sympathetic to people growing up. On the other hand, I'm reminded of years ago, there was during the Trump administration, there was a fight over a nominee for a position on the, was it on the Ninth Circuit or the District of Oregon? I can't remember. I'm blanking. But out west. And the nominee had a bunch of college writings that were both racist and sexist. Now, he, unlike Clinton, very directly said, I did write those and they don't reflect what I do now. And I apologize and I've matured and all of these things, which on the one hand is a good thing. Now, it was made a little bit testy to the extent that a lot of conservative judicial watchers, you know, your Ed Whalen's and Eli Shapiro's both were coming out and saying, oh, it's okay. We don't think that he really should have apologized, and we don't think there's anything to apologize, which made his own apology, you know, a little more suspect within the, sure, the confines of it. But that is what you want somebody to do. And so on one hand, that's a good thing. On the other hand, though, it is still somewhat problematic because, and this goes to your point about rising through the hierarchy, there's almost like a built-in plan these days that, like, be the most despicable troll possible young, mm-hmm, and that will open doors for you, yep, and you can always apologize later. The, you know, I will recant on my deathbed moment, that
you can get into heaven as long as you apologize right before you see right the gates.
And so, like, on the one hand, you want to be happy about people maturing and having apologies. On the other hand, you, to the extent that we ever reward this cursus honorum of being, mm-hmm, as awful and vile as possible while young and moving on, like, that then becomes a pattern that gets endorsed by that system. So it's problematic all the way around. Although, as you point out, this clerk has not gone the full bounds level of actually apologizing for anything.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I just want to know what the change of heart process is. Like, how does one go from, I absolutely hate black people, full stop, to, like, what, moderately dislike them? Like what's the buildings roaming there? What's the story of growth? I'm not really seeing much. It was categorical. It was categorical in its objection.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's all of our stories for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. You should subscribe to the show, get new episodes when they drop. You should be giving reviews, stars, writing things. That all helps. You should be listening to The Jabot, Catherine's other podcast. I'm also a guest on the Legal Tech Week Journalist Roundtable. You should listen to the other shows on the Legal Talk Network. You should be reading Above the Law, of course. You read these and other stories before we talk about them. You should follow everything on social media at ATL Blog, at Joseph Patrice, at Catherine One, the numeral one, the at Rights for Rent, the physical act of writing, not rights, like legal rights. Anyway, and you should do the same things on, like, Blue Sky, where I'm Joe Patrice, but otherwise everything's the same. And with all of that said, we are done for this week.
Peace.
Bye.
Peace.
If you're a lawyer running a solo or small firm and you're looking for other lawyers to talk through issues you're currently facing in your practice, Join the Unbillable Hours Community Roundtable, a free virtual event on the third Thursday of every month. Lawyers from all over the country come together and meet with me, lawyer and law firm management consultant Christopher T. Anderson, to discuss best practices on topics such as marketing, client acquisition, hiring and firing, and time management. The conversation is free to join, but requires a simple reservation. The link to RSVP can be found on the Unbillable Hour page at LegalTalkNetwork.com. We'll see you there.